Hey, everybody. Welcome to Voices from the Front Lines, the Tuesday 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and on the web, kpfk.org. I'm your host, Eric Mann. Today we devote the entire show to the 20th anniversary of the LA Rebellion of 1992. Joining us, community organizers Damon Ozzoli of the Strategy Center's Community Rights Campaign and Leonardo Vilches, director of the Union de Vecinos of Pico Aliso in East L.A. Now, today we're taking on the immense subject of the L.A. Rebellion of 1992 and our assessment of the impacts of the rebellion 20 years later. I'm joined by two community organizers, and we're going to find out where they were on the day of the rebellion. Since then, have become seasoned movement organizers and community leaders. Leonardo Vilches is the director of the Union de Vecinos of Pico Aliso in East L.A. Damon Ozzoli Rojas was an organizer for 10 years with the Strategy Center's Community Rights Campaign, which he also helped to co-found. So I think the first question I want to ask Damon is, how old were you and where were you when the 1992 urban rebellion took place?
I was 18. I was in my last month of high school. I went to Culver City High School. And when I heard the news, I was actually in Santa Monica. At that time, it is a way for my mom to kind of keep me occupied and whatnot, encouraged me to do bicycle racing. So I was training in bicycle racing, and I found out what happened. And as I came home, you know, I'm riding down the streets, and I'm seeing, you know, broken cinder block and whatnot on the street. You know, I think that was one of the first real tangible sights and visual images that I think have stayed in my mind that I think has, as I'm learning more and as I'm developing consciousness, that I kind of look back onto and say, okay, that was a turning point. And I think, unfortunately, at that time, there wasn't enough of a movement that was rooted in kind of working class, black, Latino communities that could actually take the leadership of it. And I think that's one of the things that I think would be good to explore today, because I think that is in our charge right now, is to really have that kind of working class level of all the various communities of color that are affected, and really try to exert some leadership on some of the movement that is actually happening today in terms of Occupy Wall Street, et cetera.
Well, Leonardo, I'll get to you in a minute. I mean, obviously for our listeners, most of you know this, but some of you actually, you know, we have to understand we're not even born in 1992. There are many, many so-called causes of the L.A. urban rebellion, but the most obvious one was that the LAPD was caught on videotape, certainly a year before this actual event, pulling over a man named Rodney King, and then there was a picture of 15, 20, it's hard to remember, but so many police with billy clubs just hitting this man and hitting him and hitting him and hitting him and hitting him, and it would not stop. It just went on and on and on. There was enormous outrage. And then finally the police were brought to trial for many different charges, and in a Simi Valley, California court, they were all exonerated of all charges. Where I was in Washington, D.C. at the time, having a dinner with someone about to get on a plane coming to Los Angeles. And when I saw the not guilty, not guilty, not guilty, not guilty, I just was absolutely speechless. I got back on the plane, and as we were flying into Los Angeles, the pilot said, listen, folks, we have a little bit of trouble. The entire city is up in flames. So with that, Leonardo Vilches, where were you that night, and what were some of your first thoughts?
Well, at that day, I was I was working at Dolores Mission Church at the time. I was doing community organizing in the housing projects of Pico Aliso. And like any poor community in Los Angeles, our community had been dealing with a lot of problems with the police for quite some time. And they were occupying force in the projects that made people very dependent on them and really forced the community to accept the strategies of the police in dealing with gangs and violence. So we were part of an organization that was developing alternatives. And we brought a group of women from the community to the police station to protest the verdict, actually. And we had a van of women there in front of the police station, and we got to see as things started heating up with the protests and the police response. And that was my first flavor of what the police was ready and willing to do in terms of dealing with the community. They really didn't care. There was no attempt to negotiate or deal with people who were protesting in the country, they started retrenching and creating more frustration in the community. And that's, I saw actually the explosion in downtown LA, and the police, needless to say, the women that we brought from the church, got to sit first place. We took them to the church, back to them. We were concerned about their safety. And then I came back just to see what was going on in downtown LA.
Well, Leonardo, one thing is that obviously the core of rebellion was a black rebellion, but unlike the Watts Rebellion of 1965, I believe, there was also significant Latino participation in this rebellion. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that, because I think some of the listeners might not understand that.
Yeah, well, the issue for us, and this is 6 years after the development also of a big organizing movement around Central America, so we had a large politicized community, a large level of politicization amongst immigrants because of the issues of the refugees and coming from El Salvador and Central America. And the community in Los Angeles, in Boyle Heights, where I was working, also was dealing with the police on a day-to-day basis. We had a situation where, the gang violence was on an increase. And any attempt by the community to address the issue was pretty much curtailed by the police. The police was saying, we're the only people who deal with this problem. And they would walk into these neighborhoods and deal with the youth, harass the youth, beat them up, pick them up, and take them to their neighborhoods, creating problems in the community. So there was a lot of resentment from the part of the community about what the police was doing. Actually, I think a year or two before that, there had been a kid had been shot in the projects in Ramona Gardens. So this is not something that the community was unaware of. People were feeling the tension with the police. People were seeing the police driving all around their neighborhoods. And not only that, economically, things were not much better than from the African-American community. It's just we had a different history and a different tradition. You know, most of us immigrants coming here for all sorts of reasons were, like, still trying to figure out the ropes in the system. But we were experiencing the same situations. And then with the level of politicization with the Central America movement and the high sensitivity in the very poor communities, I think people also had the frustrations.
Well, let me ask. Go ahead, Leonardo. Tell the listeners, really quick, tell the listeners, what did the Latino rebellion look like?
Well, in a lot of places I remember, I was in our case around the projects, there was a lot of our youth who started going to the factories and trying to open them up and take stuff out of there. In other places, people started coming out on protests, the problems with the police. And in other parts of the neighborhood, I remember in MacArthur Park, I mean, there was the basic response and the riots where people were going to the stores, taking stuff out. But, there was this mixture of protest and let's take care of our needs. Because, you know, I don't know if you remember, there was a lot of discussion about what people were taking out of the supermarkets. You know, they were taking diapers, they were taking water, they were taking food. The first wave was a wave where people were figuring out how to take care of their basic needs. And protests. So I think we had a mixture of protests, the people, the going into the stores, joining in on the protests, and just basically people are concerned, and also the fear and concern from people of the community about what was going to happen next.
Well, Damon, we're going to sort of fast forward and move backwards and forwards and backwards. If you look at today, I mean, we did a report called Reconstructing Los Angeles from the Bottom Up, which I'm going to talk about a little later in the show. And in looking back at it 20 years ago, one of the things we talked about is that we wanted the social welfare state, not what we call the corporate welfare state and the police state. 20 years later, we certainly know two things have happened, that there is less employment in South LA rather than more, and there's more police presence and more arrests. Where do you see the hope in terms of what drives you right now, 20 years after the rebellion, and what lessons do you get out of that rebellion that in any way perhaps shape your work today?
I think there are a number of, you talking about moving back and forth, I think there are a number of similarities in phases. So if I think about 1965, the rebellion in 65, and all of the systemic reasons that happened, and the fact that in 92 the rebellion happened again, same reasons, you know, different time period, but it was all the same reasons that you're saying, unemployment, criminalization of communities, communities who didn't have access to basic needs of health care, of food, of all these different things. You know, and I always had this idea you know, there was, I think, 27 years, 25, 27 years between those two rebellions, and I don't see the change now in terms of systemic change. I actually see it worse. And so my prediction is in another 5 to 7 years, we're going to have another one. And I think a couple reasons, I mean, you're asking kind of like, how does this inform work? So as of recently, I know people who weren't alive back then have seen a number of things in the news and the radio about what's happening to, in particular, black folks. And if I just kind of just talk about the strand of police brutality, you know, in the last couple years, you had Sean Bell in New York, who was shot on the night before he was going to get married by NYPD. Oscar Grant in Oakland, who was on a BART train station. He was handcuffed, shot, and killed. You had Kenneth Chamberlain, who was an elderly black man in New York, whose life alert system went off, and they thought that he was having a heart attack, and cops came in, tased him, shot him, killed him. Trayvon Martin. And I think it's interesting, the Trayvon Martin piece, it might not have been the system that was particularly involved, but I think the system then protected one Zimmerman and then allowed Zimmerman, and is allowing Zimmerman to be the scapegoat for structural racism that is perpetuated by the state. So you have a lot of people saying, well, we just want to arrest him. We just want to bring him to trial. But arresting him, bringing him to trial, even executing, whatever you do to him, it's still not going to actually address the root causes of why Trayvon Martin got shot, why Kenneth Chamberlain got shot, why Oscar Grant got shot. So I think some of the interesting things that are different now than, say, in 1992, I think there are kind of four things. One is social media and technology. The fact that everybody has a video camera on their phone actually exposes police brutality, exposes injustice, instead of having kind of the southern backroad lynching when nobody knows about, except for the white cops who were involved, this actually puts people on spot. And we'll see a lot of these things. Kenneth Chamberlain, it was recorded. Oscar Grant, it was videotaped. You know, you go on the line. Secondly, I think the state-induced poverty that has happened from the kind of the Wall Street grabbing of money and resources and the home foreclosure crisis, you know, I think that makes the most raw impacts on black communities, on immigrant communities of all shades. I'm talking, you know, Filipino, El Salvadoreño, et cetera, et cetera. So I think as people really see, like, this is really impacting them, it starts to change consciousness. Third, a kind of upsurge in movement activity in terms of Occupy Wall Street. I think one thing in that, there needs to be the outreach to the communities of color who are the most impacted. You know, again, all the different nations and people who are immigrants, as well as black folks. And I think then, finally, when you take it kind of broader, it's this whole idea of kind of this overextension and decline of U.S. power. So if we look, you know, at the whole idea, I think, in, you know, we talked about in our community rights campaign, when we talked about no to the police prison state, yes to the social and environmental justice state, the other piece of that was no to the military state. And I think as, you know, Leonard talked about the occupation of communities here in the U.S., in U.S. domestically, it mirrors what is happening around the world. And I think what the U.S. is doing around the world, and we see how the bully is getting kicked off the playground right now. And I think we see that internationally, and I think that's really kind of the hope. And I think all of what we've kind of talked about in terms of community rights, how do we create a movement, consciousness with black, Latino, indigenous communities, communities of color in the United States that is aware of those international links and tries to really challenge, both internally but then also with our allies internationally, challenge U.S. power, challenge the racism that is inherent in this country, which is based on stolen land, stolen people, stolen labor, and genocide. And I think as these things happen more and more, people are going to say, okay, there's no excuse. There's no, I can always rationalize my way out of it, but now you can't do it because it's happening to you. It's happening to your neighbors. It's happening to your uncles and your aunts. And I think that, you know, very soon it's gonna come to another head. And I think it's our job to be the conscious left forces that are in touch with communities of color, that say no and really put demands, some concrete demands on the system, and push forward until we get them.
Thanks, Damon. That was a real good overview of our past, present, and future. Leonardo, with a few minutes left, you've done so much work. You know, you've been such an important movement veteran. how do we understand, just as Damon was talking about, that there's growing mass incarceration of Latino people, there's growing deportations, 400,000 a year under the first, under Obama, 1.2 million in the first 3 years of Obama. Again, I want to ask us, and to really focus on, where do you see the hope when you're talking right now to immigrant communities under these, in some way, declining, rapidly declining circumstances? What gets you on the 20th anniversary of the rebellion? What gets you up in the morning? If I'm a Latino immigrant and you're trying to explain to me why I should feel in any way hopeful, what would your answer be?
Yes, well, a couple of things. One of them, I think that we also have to pay attention to the local stuff. I think that the link between the global and the local is very, very key. And just to give you an example of some of the negatives that are here and where the hope jumps from, I think it's very key to notice. I was just checking Wikipedia, and according to Wikipedia, about $1 billion were lost on the riots in 1992. Probably was more than that, probably is close to that. But just for you to get a sense of what happened in our neighborhood in Boyle Heights, between
Leonardo, you can have about 2 minutes, so I want you to get right to the present hope.
$1 billion were used for public works to displace the community, to build a bigger police station, and to dismantle all the social infrastructure that existed in Boyle Heights. These are public works that displace the community. In the meantime, through our organization, we started building a power in the neighborhood where people started recovering the space, started really developing their sense of alternative solutions to the police, and they started coming together to develop their own mechanisms to address the problems of poverty and social unrest in their neighborhoods. And I think part of the key thing here is, as Damon was saying, we have to come together to build an alternative power that looks at citizenship beyond whether you have papers or not, but more paying attention to whether you are taking control at the economic, social, and political level of your own community. And if we want to prevent the riots to happen, we will have to build that power. And we build that power every day in our neighborhoods by bringing people together, analyzing the unequal conditions that they live in, and fighting to change those conditions. And I think that's very, very key, to build that base in the neighborhoods where we're living.
And you get one more shot at another thing, Leonardo. Talk to us about the reality of a Black-Latino alliance and your vision.
Well, I knew Pete White was going to be on the conversation too, but he's not here today. But that's a great example. Both of us are working together in our communities. We're bringing together the community that he's working with, which is mostly African-American, and the community I work with in the housing projects, which in Boyle Heights, which is mostly Latino. And what we've been doing together is training our bases together, doing exchanges where people are learning through sign language and half Spanish, half English, to work together and to develop their own plans to change their own communities. That's been part of the Human Right to Housing Collaborative, and the interracial exchange and collaboration is very, very, very strong. And I think that's one thing that we changed a lot since 1992. The suspicion and the mistrust, I think, has gone down tremendously. And now it's time to get to work and build that alternative system that we have to build, because the city is broke. They keep looking to the police as a solution. They keep investing months on the police, and they're using public projects to displace our communities. It's time for us to develop our own structures.
Well, I think that's very exciting and very concrete, that Unión de Vecinos and LA CAN, as you said, Pete White's doing tremendous work. We also work at the Labor Community Strategy Center. We also work with both of you. So you're absolutely right that the growing consciousness, the specific working relationship of Black and Latino people. And what does the Community Rights Campaign and Unión Vecinos and LA CAN have to do with each other? Well, one major thing is the continued struggle about the LAPD, that, as Damon was pointing out, in the McCone Commission report and in the Kerner Commission report, both of which came out after the rebellion of 1965, they both said that, what a surprise, in virtually every single city in the country, the rebellions took place because of specific, or as they say, perceived acts of police brutality. So Damon, in terms of the last word, where do you see a future movement concretely to address demands that the people would have on the LAPD? Obviously, just very briefly talking about the truancy ticket victory, but moving to present and future.
Well, yeah, we, over the last 5 years at the Community Rights Campaign, Our goal is trying to de-incarcerate folks, to decriminalize, to get people out of jail who shouldn't be in there, who are there because they're Black, Latino, and poor. We had a victory earlier this year in which we won back money for working class Black and Latino families. in terms of stopping $250 to $800 truancy tickets given to students who were going to school who were just 5 minutes late. So I think, you know, as we look forward, I think, you know, an interview that we had a long time ago with Mike Farrell from Deaf Planning Focus on Voices from the Frontlines, the question that you asked were saying, you know, and this is, you know, on the verge of a ballot initiative that's going to potentially in California stop the death penalty. Each particular thing, whether it's death penalty, whether it's police brutality, whether it's three strikes, what is the entryway to that? It is police. It's how police behave. It is the laws that help protect them when they get out of control. That's the main piece. And I think that when all of the folks on the left who are dealing with all these people see how that the police and the police state is, one, oppressing people, but then, two, stealing money from city workers, stealing money from healthcare, et cetera, and we really focus on that and see the link through that, then I think that that's when we have a movement that will be much like, I think, more long-term. But if you see and, you know, read the stuff and you were there and saw it on TV in 92, you had people in the streets who were causing the cops to run away. And I think, you know, we need to be really clear with our demands and really say, this is what we want and this is what we don't want. And I think building between communities is important, just what Leonardo said. But I think also just it's a conversation that keeps coming up, and knowing that a lot of our foundations, the foundations that fund our work, they're going to give people money to meet with the cops, but not to fight the cops. And I think we need to fight the cops, and we need to be really clear about what we want and how we want to control them.
Part of that is to take at least half of their budget from the city, because they're occupying a big chunk of the budget, and it's time to just bring it down to 20% of the budget or less.
Well, I want to end with that. I mean, I think that it's interesting, because in reconstructing LA from the bottom up, the Strategy Center has a slogan called 1,000 more buses, 1,000 less police. And I think, as both Damon and Leonardo are pointing out, in some way the defunding of the police is going to be critical to the actual control, that it's not just enough to say we're going to have civilian control of the police, or we're going to win this or win that. In some ways, the people are going to have to decide if we want dramatically less police, because the only way to get a lot less policing is to get a lot less police to start with. So great to have you both on the show. I think these are some voices from the front lines today. I think if you listen to the militant edge coming from both Leonardo and Damon, this isn't past talk from the 60s. This is happy to say it's happening in 2012. For me, that's my moment of hope, is listening to both of you. So great to have you on the show, and we'll keep the conversation going.